The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, FA Cup. Big day for Chelsea, who win v Luton and lose alleged friend of Putin, while Borough cancels Spurs' trophy hopes. Premier League, Leeds become the men from Marsh and Manchester Derby. Will Pep's rank spank fellow Manx? Plus, Matt v Jules in the Intertotally and much, much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And hello, listener. Thursday, March the 3rd. It's been a lot this week, and here to make sense of it all, Tom Williams, Adrian Clarke, and Charlie Eccleshare. Hello.
Hello, James.
Hello.
Oh, nice. All right. As you just heard, so much for us to discuss today, not least those midweek cup games, which you were quietly thrilled by, Adrian and Tom, possibly you as well, Charlie, but you weren't online when we were having that chat.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I thought that Luton gave it a real go against Chelsea. Okay, they ran out of energy, I think, in the second half and lacked a bit of quality. But yeah, the Middlesbrough game for me was the standout. It was a Championship side raising their game, playing like a Premier League outfit, and you know what they did to Tottenham Hotspur at the Riverside Stadium was just remarkably impressive, given how easily Spurs spanked Leeds in the previous game. I was commentating on that game. Spurs were, you know, slicing through Leeds at will. Up against a tactically savvy Borough, it was very different.
It was the worst display of the Conte era, according to one Charles Eccleshare.
Yeah, I mean, this game or Mora, the infamous Europa Conference League defeat. The mitigation for Mora would be that they played an hour of it pretty much with 10 men. Whereas this, as Adrian says, this wasn't an upset that, you know, was a backs to the wall kind of, we're just going to ride our luck and pinch what we can on the break. They were much the better side. I mean, Spurs probably shaded the first half, but after that, Middlesbrough were well on top, I thought. And yeah, I mean, I think it was just that element of it that really struck me. And that was said straight after the game, that it was the, you know, being so outplayed by a team in the league below, not just beaten by them.
And that Josh Coburn goal felt like a proper old school FA Cup moment. This like gangly 19-year-old sub who comes on.
Here's Crooks. And there is Coburn. Joy.
And one of the truest strikes I think I've ever seen. I almost ripped the net off, and then the look on his face as he ran over to the fans. And you know, as we know, the FA Cup is a much maligned competition. But I feel like the last couple of seasons, at least, have thrown up some really decent storylines and some really decent upsets
and some really decent goals as well. The Phil Foden to Jack Grealish one in the Peterborough Man City game. Also the Romain Perrault effort. Oof. Rocket, really, in Southampton's win over West Ham. The results, anyway, midweek, fifth round, two games still to play Thursday night. It'll be Everton against Boreham Wood, and then next Monday, Nottingham Forest against Huddersfield. But so far, Chelsea have beaten Luton 3-2, coming back from 2-1 down at half-time. Liverpool beat Norwich 2-1. That's the fourth time they've beaten them this season. Stay down, Canaries. Saints, 3-1 winners against West Ham. Borough put out Spurs, having previously put out Man United, of course. Crystal Palace booked a place in the quarterfinals with a 2-1 win over Stoke. And Man City beat Peterborough 2-0. Right. Now, as mentioned at the top, Wednesday was a busy one for Chelsea. A 3-2 victory at Kenilworth Road with Timo Werner and Romelu Lukaku turning around that 2-1 half-time deficit. Chelsea reaching the quarterfinals for the third season in a row. Off the field, meanwhile, owner Roman Abramovich announcing his decision to sell the club after almost 19 years at the helm. Sale of the club will not be fast-tracked, says the announcement, but will follow due process. I will not be asking for any loans to be repaid. There's talk as well of any profits from the sale going to help Ukraine. To talk about that and more, The Athletic's Adam Crafton now joins us. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, why?
We don't know officially, in that, you know, he's not given a clear reason other than that he wants to, he says he wants to do, you know, act in the best interests of Chelsea Football Club. We also know that he doesn't take questions. We know that Chelsea's directors don't take questions. We know the only person who is taking questions is Thomas Tuchel, who clearly doesn't have any answers to what's happening at the moment. In a broader sense, we know there was a Russian invasion of Ukraine that started last Thursday, and very quickly MPs were standing up in the British Parliament and naming Roman Abramovich as one of the individuals, one of the very successful, wealthy Russian individuals who should be sanctioned due to purported links that he may have to the Kremlin. And, you know, these are links that have been always denied by Chelsea, always denied by spokespeople of Abramovich. But these calls have got louder and louder. On Monday, Boris Johnson took a question from a Ukrainian journalist at a press conference, who was almost in tears, naming Roman Abramovich, asking why he hadn't been sanctioned. Then you have Prime Minister's questions, where the Labour leader Keir Starmer stands up and asks why Abramovich has not yet been sanctioned. And what we know about Abramovich is that he's almost this symbol of Londongrad. So regardless of whatever his, and by Londongrad, I mean, I suppose, Russian money in the UK, you know, he's the most famous person that, you know, famous Russian that we would associate with the UK because of his ownership of Chelsea Football Club. And then, you know, there's two big statements over the weekend. Saturday night, Abramovich drops a statement, tries to transfer the stewardship of the club to the charity that runs the foundation. By Sunday afternoon, it had become very clear that the six trustees, you know, one of which was the women's team's manager, Emma Hayes, the other was an anti-discrimination campaigner, Piara Power, they were looking at it and just saying, don't think so, not for me, essentially. You know, to be doing this at this moment, we're going to need a lot more information. They'd only found out about it about an hour or so before the actual statement dropped on the Chelsea website. We then had a statement on Sunday morning on the Chelsea website talking about a conflict in Ukraine, not referring to a Russian invasion, not referring to Russia at all, I don't think, in that statement. So that's been the momentum since then has been towards Abramovich may receive sanctions from either the British government, European government, or US government. Those sanctions still haven't come in at the point we talk, and they may not come in. But there was a political momentum aligned with this continued barbarity in Ukraine that was making it really sort of completely unsustainable for Abramovich to not act. And I think that's why on Wednesday night, the statement dropped on Chelsea's website to say that he's ready to sell the club and that there will be a sales process. I mean, you mentioned that there'll be a foundation set up for victims of the war in Ukraine. He's still not made clear who will run that foundation. Why a foundation needs to be set up when there's lots of charities, established international charities, that could just take the money as it is, where we would know for sure how that's being spent, where that's going. He's not made clear whether that will be going to Russian victims of Ukraine or Ukrainian victims of what's going on there at the moment. So there's a lot of things we don't have answers to. There's a lot of things that would be very helpful if he took some questions, but that's where we are.
Okay. There'll be a lot of Chelsea fans who are saying, well, why aren't you discussing what a great owner he's been? But that's not really what today's discussion is about. And I think there are bigger issues behind Abramovich, whatever his success with the club, given the situation in Ukraine and the suffering of the people there. Can I ask, do you know, Adam, is there any equivalent situation for Alistair Usmanov at Everton, who has now been sanctioned by the EU? Is there a suggestion that there might be a similar step away from Everton?
Well, I mean, Alisher Usmanov is not a shareholder of Everton, so he doesn't have anything to step away from officially. What is the case is that the owner of Everton, Farhad Moshiri, is the chair of Usmanov's fund. But Usmanov himself is not a shareholder of Everton. What we do know, however, is that Usmanov-linked companies, USM, Megaphone, Yotta, are prominent Everton sponsors. I'd estimate probably between 15 to 20 million pounds a year that Everton make via training ground sponsorship, kit deals for the women's team, things like that. And then also Usmanov has the first right of refusal, which he's paid £30 million for, to have the naming rights for Everton's new stadium. So at a minimum level, Everton stand to lose quite a lot of money from sponsorship. And Everton are one of those teams over the last few years who have spent an absolute fortune trying to compete on the pitch, often pretty poorly. But it leaves them in this very, very difficult situation where they're trying to fulfil financial fair play and profit and sustainability regulations. And that sponsorship money is absolutely essential for them to comply. So that's going to be an issue. The other issue is, whether Farhad Moshiri, as, you know, the chair of this fund, chooses to step away from the fund in some way.
I just wanted to ask, Adam, Abramovich sort of in his statement mentioned that he'd like to one last time to say goodbye to all the fans in person. It's something I just can't see ever happening. It's going to be a sort of quiet exit and that's it, surely.
Well, I mean, there certainly seems to be a willingness from Chelsea fans, and John Terry and Jason Cundy are all lining up for the leaving party. So I think, you know, I'm sure if it is possible, Chelsea would like to make that happen. There is a challenge in that, you know, Roman Abramovich withdrew his visa application, his investor visa, in 2018 amid, you know, diplomatic tensions between Russia and the UK. He's only been back a couple of times, as far as I'm aware. He came back on one occasion where he was basically part of the Israeli Prime Minister's entourage on a Holocaust memorial occasion. I don't think he's been back to Stamford Bridge. Look, I think it would be a pretty farcical situation if he is to be sanctioned, if you were then to have him on the pitch at Stamford Bridge getting a standing ovation. Have we seen more ridiculous things in football? I'm not sure. Have we? I don't know. Have we? It's a good question.
I mean, we've just had celebrating the Saudi, you know, welcoming our brave Saudi overlords at St. James's Park. Yeah. Have you been surprised, Adam, with the reaction sort of from, I don't know, it feels like by lots of people he is being celebrated and venerated as this kind of, you know, he came with a few billion pounds and a dream and look what he achieved. Kind of, you know, there's been almost this like romanticising of what Abramovich has done.
Yeah, I think there has been. Look, I think if you are a Chelsea fan, and particularly if you've grown up over the last 15 years, this guy has made you really happy. And the other thing is, because of the nature of the moment we're at, where sanctions haven't been imposed yet, we don't actually know what Abramovich has done, if anything. You know, we've not been provided with evidence, which is legally substantiated in terms of sanctions at the moment. So some Chelsea fans will be looking at it and just thinking, well, you know, Russia's gone to war, Putin's gone to war, this is just a successful Russian businessman. And that's what Chelsea would like their fans to be thinking. And that is a message that they have for a very long time infiltrated into their fan base.
It's a message that has been, I think, accepted by everybody. Since Abramovich arrived, he was the super wealthy guy who transformed a club and pretty much the Premier League as well. And everyone was happy, for whatever reason, to run with that as a story. You would get some mentions, but peripherally, of other things that his money was financing or other links that he would have. But I can understand, while I don't take this view, but I can understand why Chelsea fans and Chelsea players who have some personal contact with him would go, hang on, for the last 15 years or 19 years, sorry, he's been this figure, and now you want us to suddenly pitch 180 because you're all doing that because it's now okay to say other stuff. I do get why they might feel that's hypocritical.
Like all these things, life is complicated. There are positive aspects to it. He's done a load of campaigning against anti-Semitism, which has been, you know, really impressive at times. He has put a load of money into local projects in Chelsea, in the area, in the same way that, you know, Manchester City would say their owners have, and that the Newcastle owners will say they have. And, you know, there is an argument he has improved people's lives in some way. At the same time, we see the footage from Ukraine, we see the images from Ukraine, and we see that Roman Abramovich, you know, you have MPs calling for sanctions. And it's a very, 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 very difficult thing, I think, for people who just go along on a Saturday to watch their team as an escape, to get their head round. And the final thing is, on Monday, his spokesperson was saying that he'd actually been invited by Ukraine, by some Ukrainian officials, it wasn't very clear who, it was a Ukrainian actor that vouched for it, to help broker peace talks in Belarus between Ukraine and Russia. And this was after years of us being told that Abramovich is a person, you know, without any political connections, without any political links. And all of a sudden he was being contacted by Ukrainian actors to act as a mediator. I can completely understand why Chelsea supporters or anyone would look at this and just be like, what the f***? What is going on? And it's really difficult to get your head round.
Adam, whatever happens with the sale and Chelsea, the bigger issue is what's happening to the people in Ukraine at the moment. And you did a remarkable piece this week speaking with various people from the football community there, whose experiences reflect the horrors being faced by so many millions from every walk of life.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, once you actually have those conversations, the idea of just sort of returning, you know, in your head to this, to worrying about what's going to happen to this really rich dude and his billions, and whether he's going to lose 2 billion or instead of 13 billion, becomes quite difficult. And however talented you are, however famous you are, however privileged you might have been in Ukraine a week ago, is now absolutely irrelevant. You know, you have Shakhtar Donetsk footballers, players who were playing against Real Madrid and Inter Milan 5 months ago, 70 caps for Ukraine. Taras Stepanenko, who I was speaking to, his wife and kids were in a basement that they'd converted into a bomb shelter for 2 days. And they then drove through the night, couldn't use any main roads, were having to go all around the villages. He was saying, you know, I didn't even know these roads. I was just guessing as he was trying to drive southwest out of Kyiv to an area more towards the western borders, which are a little bit safer at the moment with a family friend. And, you know, you're doing these interviews with, you hear their kids in the background in these basements. You hear, you know, basically bombardments going off in the distance. And it's just horrific. It's exactly, you know, what we are watching on the news is what is happening. It's the truth. There's been some amazing stuff that's been done as well, you know, particularly by the Ukrainian Football Federation. They had a lot of international footballers, Brazilians, Spaniards, Italians, that were trapped when the bomb started, because the Ukrainian league season hadn't been suspended before the invasion started. There was a lot of people who thought that it should have been, because there was a lot of intelligence to say that this invasion was coming, but it hadn't been. And, you know, you could say, to the credit, I suppose, of the international players, a lot of them had decided to stay until the end with their Ukrainian counterparts, saying, you know, we're going to stick this out until we really have to. But it left, you know, there were 70 strong group of Shakhtar and Dynamo Kyiv players in the Opera Hotel in Kyiv on Thursday morning, Friday night, with babies, running out of food, running out of nappies. And eventually, between UEFA and a federation, they got them out towards the Romanian border. You know, other players had it far more difficult. Three Brazilians from Zorya Luhansk, one of them is 18 years old, has gone to Ukraine, not earning that much money to try and get a break in Europe, and finds himself walking 50 kilometres through a war scene to try and get towards the border. I mean, and he was with a teammate who was carrying his kid on his back. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. And I don't know, I struggle really to say much more than that, other than, yeah.
Mm. Well, those are the ones who got out. There are others from all walks of life, of course, who are still there, and our thoughts very much with them. Adam, thank you so much. The piece is really worth reading. It's up on The Athletic at the moment. And we'll speak to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
So, the FA Cup. We talked a little bit about Spurs. Adrian, tell us about the extraordinary Chris Wilder's Borough.
Oh, they were awesome, weren't they? They played with so much confidence, comfort on the ball. And that is down to coaching. He has given the players belief that they can play in this quite sophisticated way, and he's done it in a matter of weeks, really. He's not been there too long, Chris Wilder, and just the fluency of their passing, their movement, the confidence of the players was great to see. I thought that the right back, Isaiah Jones, who's been superb all season, really, he would walk into the Tottenham side, wouldn't he? I mean, he would.
And so would Jed Spence. They have two right backs who would walk into the
absolutely,
the
absolutely. And they could have had more goals. Obviously, a couple of, you know, Gyökeres chances from Crooks and Housen from corners. It was brilliant from them, but you have to say, weak-minded from Tottenham.
Yeah, it was one of those, just on Wilder as well. I was at the game, and you do get a feeling of something building sometimes, you know, at these kind of matches, and it does feel like they're all so behind that team. The momentum was really building throughout that game, and you feel in a sort of wider sense as well. But yeah, I mean, but like Housen summed it up, really. I mean, his attitude and... You know, we in the age of data analytics, whatever, we try not to talk about these intangibles too much. But it did feel like his attitude really set the tone. And I think the Spurs midfield were a bit knackered. The other two were injured, so they had to play Winks and Højbjerg again. And they didn't look like they had the legs for it. But also, it felt like their hearts must have sank quite early on when they were like, Housen is not going to give us a moment's rest tonight. He's just on us every single time. And he got away with a pretty meaty tackle early on that didn't get a booking for. And I think that just gave him even greater license to say, go on, be an absolute pain. And he played really well, nearly scored as well. But yeah, very impressed with him and the team's attitude overall.
Charlie, as someone that follows Spurs closely, do you think that Tottenham now and in the last few decades... Do you think that part of this issue where they can't seem to get, you know, climb that mountain and win the trophy, do you think it's that they accept finishing second best is okay? It feels to me as if like the truly elite teams, the ones that are gobbling up all the trophies, they just have this fear of losing, of finishing second best. And I just don't get that impression with the culture at Tottenham Hotspur. It's almost an acceptance that they'll come close, but
I mean, have we got enough time on this podcast to try and explain what's wrong with Tottenham Hotspur? I suspect perhaps not.
That is a big question, but that tension, what you're describing, Adrian, as well, is what Conte has walked into, and I think he's desperately trying to change that. He's actually spoken about that very issue and saying that, you know, the atmosphere he wants to create and that he's created at his former clubs is where a loss is, the mood should be horrific for the days after. You know, you should be absolutely raging about it. And, you know, he said he hasn't got that impression. And it was really funny after one of the defeats, I think it was Burnley maybe, all the Spurs, you know, put up the training pics or whatever. And there was not a single one of them smiling. It was all, you know, looking serious and really sad and moody in training. And you do wonder if this was an attempt to kind of show Conte that, yeah, we're on board with this messaging that this is unacceptable. But yeah, I mean, I was going to say, it feels like every time I come on this, it's on this podcast, off the back of a Spurs defeat. But then I was thinking, I come on basically every other week and they lose literally every other game. So yeah, it's actually not so really that surprising.
It's 13 fixtures in all competitions in which they've almost perfectly alternated between wins and losses. There was one little stretch in the middle where they did two defeats in a row just to kind of spice life up. As Adrian mentions, it is another season without silverware. 2008 League Cup is the last trophy they won. If Duncan were here, he'd mention that this summer, their last title will be closer to the 1800s than it is to today, which is a remarkable statistic. However, silver lining time, in terms of their top four challenge, this could be a boost because now it's only training ground with Conte preparing for each game, and the next one being Everton on Monday night.
Well, yeah, this is Conte, what he's sort of staked his reputation on, is that, you know, these weeks on the training pitch with him are so valuable, and the mind obviously goes back to that 16-17 season with Chelsea where they weren't in Europe and they were able to have these full weeks and it worked out really well. There's always been the sense with him that's, you know, he's never been particularly good in European competition, and the feeling's been that he's, you know, been very good with kind of the free weeks, but juggling a lot of competitions has never been that easy. So yeah, maybe it will be a benefit, but you know, the side issue, and someone raised this, and I'd be interested to get your guys' thoughts, is, you know, Kane will go another season without winning a trophy. And is there anyone in modern football, in the era of stratification where the same teams tend to win the trophies, anyone in modern football that's close to Kane for having not won, you know, for someone of his ability not winning a trophy? I mean, it is obviously it was asked probably in a slightly trolley way, but it is quite an interesting thought. I mean, it is crazy that he hasn't won anything as he approaches 29.
I mean, the only player who comes to mind is Alan Shearer, but then he, of course, won
but
the
he did
Premier
win a
League
title.
Very early yeah. in his career. So he, you know, you couldn't hit him with a never won a trophy stick. And I think you feel like the longer Kane stays at Spurs and the more goals he scores and the further he climbs the various all-time records tables, you know, does he end up reaching a tipping point where just committing to being a Tottenham legend and breaking every record at the club and overhauling Shearer's Premier League goal-scoring record becomes as valid an objective as winning silverware? It obviously isn't at the moment because we know, you know, he wanted to leave the club last summer. But I just wonder, given the difficulties he's had extracting himself from the club and you know, being tied to the contract that he's tied to, will we get to a point, if he's still there in the next 2 or 3 years, which is perhaps not all that likely, you know, given the way things are going, will he at some point embrace that kind of, you know, one club man hero status? But yeah, I suspect if you were to present him with a choice today, he'd probably go for something a bit more exciting.
Just checking, is top four still a trophy or not?
It would feel like one. It would right. feel like one. I think Wenger was ahead of the curve with that. I mean,
he was.
You know, he as with so many things, he was mocked. But I mean, the only comparable player to Kane a lot of people have put forward is Son Heung-min. Which yeah. You know, as someone who's which, you know, you can say, doesn't that sum Spurs up? But
yeah, it's now or never. He won't get that big move beyond this summer. It has to be this summer. Then I think he has to reconcile himself, Harry Kane, that he just will be a Tottenham legend and smash all the records.
The one thing I would say about Kane is that I don't think he is going to age as quickly as some players age, and particularly as some strikers age, because he's never been quick. There is a kind of Teddy Sheringham element to his game, which means that the Kane we see 5 years from now shouldn't look too different to the Kane we see today. So, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that he spends another couple of years at Spurs, maybe sees out his contract and still gets a big move, because potential suitors won't look at him and think, oh, well, we should have got him when he was 22, 23, when he was leaving centre-backs for dead, because that never happened.
5 years from now, when we'll probably still be having this conversation about Kane and Spurs. But Charlie, finish us off for now with one last point.
Well, I was just going to... It's funny Tom brings up Sheringham, because I was going to bring him up as an example. He moved to United when he was 31 and won everything. Kane will be 31, or just turning 31, when his contract expires. So it is possible he can have both of these things. He can more or less achieve everything. You know, he can potentially break the, you know, Tottenham goal scoring record in the next couple of years and then move to one of the trophy hoovering up clubs as he turns 31, and then have a coda to his career where he does get the honours he wants, because it's going to be another summer where it's not easy to get the move he wants.
Yeah. Very quickly on commentary, because I did commentary in the Leeds Spurs game where Kane was just irresistible. And during the course of that commentary, I threw it out there. Has there been a better playmaking centre-forward than Harry Kane? I mean, he's like Shearer and Sheringham rolled into one, isn't he? He's a remarkable player.
He certainly is, Adrian. He certainly is. Now, in other non-Harry Kane-related news, who else saw what? The Foden-Grealish goal was ridiculous, no?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that first touch from Grealish, proper Birmingham Baggio stuff. And I also feel like it was one of the first real moments that he's given us in a City shirt. He scored a really nice goal in the Champions League group phase, didn't he, against Leipzig, I think, where he picked it up on the left and drove in and scored. But, you know, particularly given the huge transfer fee and all the expectation that there was around Grealish in the summer, we haven't had that many moments like that. But yeah, certainly seeing him score goals like that will do him good, and, you know, just sort of shows that he is, you know, he is being effective, even if he isn't quite hitting the heights that people might have expected of him.
And that was a gorgeous goal. I don't think you get any better touches than that.
Riyad Mahrez also scoring in that game. That's his 19th of the season, which makes this his highest scoring campaign in England. Crystal Palace with a 2-1 victory against Stoke. Intriguingly, Patrick Vieira is now unbeaten in his last 18 games in the FA Cup as a player and manager. How about Saints, though? That 3-1 win over West Ham. Mentioned the Romain Perrault rocket. Also, Breuer's goal, pretty good, the third. And Saints continue to look like a team with quite a bit of momentum behind them.
Yeah, and despite the fact that Ralf Hasenhüttl made 9 changes to his starting 11, which is pretty remarkable. And West Ham were pretty much full strength. And as it happened, Hasenhüttl brought on a few of his typical starters towards the end. So, for example, you know, Breuer came off the bench and scored that lovely goal. But yeah, I think it shows how healthy the dynamic is at Southampton, that they can shuffle the pack to that extent and still produce performances like that. I mean, that Romain Perrault goal was an absolute beauty.
Squares it across the West Ham half to Perrault. This time he's going to hit it! Oh, my goodness me! Like Stuart Armstrong in the fourth round, he has smashed a beauty from outside the box, on the angle, past Areola.
He's not starting at the moment because they've moved Kyle Walker-Peters over to the left to accommodate Tino Livramento on the right-hand side. But yeah, Saints really flying.
Breuer's a player, James. He really is. This season, I think strikers have struggled in general. I think the attacking midfielders or wide forwards have been the stars of the show. As a centre forward, I think he's got incredible potential. I really do. I did some analysis on him recently. And one of the stats that really caught my eye, because he's been dipping in and out of the team, he's not had that much game time, Breuer. No one had scored, up until I think last weekend, no one had scored more right-footed goals per 90 minutes than Breuer in the Premier League this season, which I thought was a real sign of how deadly he has potential to be.
Intriguing. Well, the Southampton put West Ham out. They've still got the Europa League to play for. They drew Sevilla, serial winners of this tournament, as you may have seen in the Europa League last 16. That'll be coming up next week. Before that, West Ham have Liverpool, who had another win over Norwich, slightly more measured one this time, just 2-1. Both of the goals coming from Takumi Minamino, who's got insane stats, actually. 7 goals in 8, I think the commentator was saying, on Wednesday night. Anyway, as Jurgen Klopp takes Liverpool to the FA Cup quarterfinals for the first time. Everton Boreham Wood is tonight, with the draw for the quarterfinals just before kickoff there. And then Monday, it's Nottingham Forest against Huddersfield. Next up, we'll be moving on to the Premier League weekend.
So, Mr. Ranić, what's troubling you? Well, we've got a leak in the dressing room, Doctor. Right, and you want to find out who it is? No, I just can't find a good plumber.
Sometimes there's only so much you can do, but with Paddy Power, our offers are watertight. So this weekend, get money back as a free bet if one leg of your 4+4 bet builder lets you down. Paddy Power. Pre-match online bet builder bets only. Min odds 1-5 per leg. Max free bet £10 per day. 7-day free bet expiry. Excludes enhanced match odds. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Inter Totally's on the way. Stand by for a fat slice of Matt Davis-Adams against Julien Laurens. Very exciting confrontation there. Totally Football League Show is out with you on a Thursday, talking about all sorts of things, including Steve Bruce's start at West Brom, which hasn't been great. 1 point from 5 games, 1 goal in 5 games. And their chances of finishing top 6, not looking great. Also, just to flag up our Totally Football Show live, which will be in Manchester at the Lowry Theatre on the 19th of April. If you wish to be there, head to thelowry.com and buy a ticket. Premier League this weekend. Woof. Saturday's early kickoff sees Leicester host Leeds, Jesse Marsh's first game in charge of the Yorkshire club. Leicester, who were 2-0 winners over Burnley on Tuesday, with Jamie Vardy back on the score sheet. Crikey. 3 o'clock on Saturday, Burnley host Chelsea, Villa face Saints, Newcastle get a visit from Brighton, Wolves take on Crystal Palace, and there's a huge six-pointer thing between Norwich, who are defending their bottom three status against plummeting relegation wannabes Brentford. Tea time, Liverpool-West Ham, two games on Sunday, Watford-Arsenal, and yes, Manchester City against Manchester United, before on Monday the round concludes with Spurs-Everton. All games, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, will feature a show of solidarity with Ukraine, say the Premier League. All right, we're going to begin with the lunchtime kickoff, Leicester-Leeds. Tweet of the week, I would suggest, comes from Colin Miller, who says, beware the ideas of Marsh. Jesse Marsh's first game in charge of Leeds, a club who conceded a record 20 goals in February, taking just 1 point from five matches. What will the arrival of the American bring? Well, let's hear from someone who saw him work his magic at Red Bull Salzburg, Lee Wingate from the Other Bundesliga podcast. Lee, first of all, how excited are you at seeing how Jesse Marsh gets on in the Premier League at Leeds?
Very much so. I mean, his time in Salzburg was hugely successful. He was a very popular guy here. He won the double, which is pretty much the bare minimum in Austria when you're at Salzburg. That's what's expected on the domestic scene. Perhaps he slightly underachieved in Europe, and then he's had a bit of a tough time at Leipzig recently, but he's a big believer in himself. He's a staunch believer in his own philosophy, and I think he'll back himself to get Leeds out of trouble.
All right. Other factors may be in play, though, as regards Leeds and trouble and all that kind of thing. It didn't work out well this season with Bielsa. To what extent do you think the problems that he had at Leipzig may reoccur at Leeds?
Well, I think one of the main problems he had at Leipzig was he came in after someone who was hugely successful, Julian Nagelsmann. And that is, of course, the case here with Bielsa. Nagelsmann had introduced this real possession-based style of football. He'd come away sort of from the traditional Red Bull high press. And Jesse came in and I think really tried to implement that pressing style of football that he favours. And I think that, you know, the players struggled a little bit with that. Some interviews with Peter Galashi, the goalkeeper I read, he said, you know, we were trying to do what the coach wanted, but instinctively we'd been drilled to play another way. So he's going to have to go in and really try and get his message across. And I actually see a bit of a parallel in that situation that he had at Leipzig and what he might face at Leeds, because I know Bielsa was a big believer in man marking and Jesse prefers to play zonal. So he's going to have to make sure that he goes in and really gets that message across much more quickly than he did at Leipzig, where, of course, he only lasted 4 months in the end.
Absolutely. Tactically, he's an attacking coach. In terms of the defensive issues that Leeds have had, do you see that being helped much by his appointment?
He is a very attacking coach. I mean, most English football fans will remember that 4-3 at Anfield, where his expletive-laden half-time team talk sort of stole the show.
Yeah, this is a f***ing Champions League spiel. We must in Cooper League off the Platz and get f***ing stuck in with Druk.
That is pretty much Jesse in microcosm, really. His teams concede a lot of goals and score a lot of goals. That was the same at Salzburg. I think last season, when Jesse was there at this stage of the season, Salzburg had conceded twice as many goals as they have this season. So I think his defensive vulnerabilities are kind of, I'd say, his shortcoming and what I'd be worried about with Leeds. You know, I don't follow the Premier League and Leeds all that closely, but I do know that they've been shipping a lot of goals recently. And to bring in then an ultra-attacking coach, which I think Jesse is, that may be a bit of a risk.
Right, but the halftime team talk should be more lively.
Yeah, they should be. And as well, I think Jesse will benefit from the fact that he's actually going to be speaking his mother tongue. This will be the first time he's done that in quite some time, because he came to Austria and then Germany and really tried to speak German at every occasion, something that really endeared him to the fans here. At least one thing he's got going for him now is that he's going to be speaking English on a regular basis.
Thoughts? You optimistic? Another Bradley? Or is everyone doing him a disservice just because he's an American?
I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that succeeding Marcelo Bielsa is one of the, if not the most difficult jobs in football, because his approach to the game is so unique, and to unpick those 3.5 years of very unique Bielsa coaching, you know, the man marking and all the rest of it, is going to be very, very difficult. Plus, you've got the fact that Bielsa, although, you know, he left with Leeds in a relegation dogfight, is a complete hero and remains worshipped by Leeds supporters. So you've got the kind of the difficulties on the playing side, you've got the kind of difficulties of succeeding someone who is held in such high esteem, and the fact he's an American as well. And as you know, poor old Bob Bradley can testify, Americans talking about football is not something that, for some baffling reason, the football fans of the United Kingdom seem ready to accept. And Jesse March is someone who likes to talk about football, who has very clear ideas about the game and is a great communicator. And that will be a real contrast to Bielsa, because, you know, I feel like we never really heard from Bielsa, because he was always speaking through an interpreter, and he was always gazing at his shoes during his post-match interviews. It was like he kind of, you know, he was here for as long as he was, but he left without us really knowing him. And Leeds are now going to find themselves with a manager who is much more sort of audible, you know, in contrast to Bielsa. So it's a tricky one. And it will be fascinating to see how he goes about the challenge of trying to kind of un-Bielsify Leeds. How much can he expect to even un-Bielsify them between now and the end of the season? Or does he have to try and find some kind of halfway house?
I don't think he has to rip it up and start again, because his own ideals are quite similar to Marcelo Bielsa in terms of like playing on the transitions and working hard from the front and whatnot. You know, his teams have always been really ferocious in their work rate. So he will inherit a dressing room that are on board with that straight away, because it's what they're used to. I think it's as simple as ditching this man-to-man marking nonsense. It was a utter car crash.
How easy is that for players, Adrian?
Oh, players hate it. Players hate doing man-to-man. In training sessions, many of the clubs I was with, the coach would sometimes say for 10, 15, 20 minutes, right, you two, man-to-man. And it would be seen as a punishment. Because you were basically, it was mano-mano. And it was like, this guy's going to run me everywhere I don't want to go, and I'm going to try to do the same to him. And that was, you know, it was horrendous, really unenjoyable. So I think that the players will be okay with ditching that. Not least because they were getting it so wrong. I mean, Son just took the right back into the middle of the pitch just to leave the space for Sessegnon. It was just so basic. And if the Spurs player was quicker than the Leeds winger that was being asked to track back, they had no chance. And Spurs could have scored eight or nine goals in that game. I think they had to make that change. It was just broken.
You know, there was talk with Bielsa from some quarters of, you know, just get him out, get a safe pair of hands in to steer them to relegation. As if you were talking about a group of underachieving star players. I mean, we're talking about largely championship level players, or at least they were before Bielsa came in. So I'll be very interested to see what happens when he's not there, whether those improvements they made have been sustainable as individuals, or whether it was about having this system, having this chemistry that worked perfectly.
It's intriguing as well from Leeds' point of view that having made that decision to make the change, they didn't go with what you might term a safe pair of hands. They've gone with what essentially is another bold experiment, a manager who hasn't got Premier League experience and is coming from a particularly unsuccessful stint at a big club in Germany. Tom?
Yeah, and just on Leicester, I think that win at Burnley in midweek was a very significant one, in that it was most notably their first league win of the year, which is both an indication of how poor their form has been and how many games they've had called off. And, you know, a Burnley team who had been on what looked like a bit of a mini revival. And, you know, we've seen how a few opposing teams have struggled at Turf Moor in recent weeks, not to just be gratuitously bashing Tottenham at every opportunity. And yeah, I think Jamie Vardy being back is big for them. They've got other players coming back from injury. James Maddison is in a great run of form. They've got lots of games in hand to get through. So yeah, it feels like Leicester for the first time in a little while have got a bit of useful momentum behind them.
Yeah, Harvey Barnes was magnificent the other night against Burnley as well. Now, Nick Pope kept the score down. So it was really impressive, actually. And you know what? Even though their results have been very average, Leicester, of late, I think they've been quite unlucky. The West Ham game, they should have won that. The Spurs game.
Wolves game.
The Wolves game, they were better than Wolves. I think they've left a few points sort of out there on the pitch, really. So I see quite a lot of positives. This is a really hard start for Jesse Marsh and Leeds United. They are in trouble because they can't defend. And if you struggle to defend and you're always leaking goals, then you're not going to win very many games, are you? Mm.
Very true indeed. Leeds 2 points from the bottom three. Burnley in 18th have a game in hand on them. Burnley this weekend have a visit from Chelsea to Turf Moor. Their recent record, Claret's not been bad. They only lost, that Leicester loss was only their second in their last eight games. And of course, against Chelsea, they drew 1-1 at Stamford Bridge in November.
Bit of a smash and grab that, but yeah.
It was a massive smash and grab, wasn't it? Yeah, from my collection.
Other sides down the bottom, Watford host Arsenal, who've won three games in a row, and they'll have had 10 days off by the time they go to Vicarage Road. Everton, who are 1 point off the drop but do have a couple of games in hand, are at Spurs on Monday. The key game this weekend down the bottom is probably Norwich-Brentford. Brentford, who are 3 points off the bottom three but have played more games than any of the sides in the bottom half. They've only picked up 1 point from the last 24 available. Haven't won in their last 9 away games in the Premier League. Daniel's story on Monday suggesting that were they to lose this game, we could see them make a change, you know? Oh, should also mention, did you remember when Norwich couldn't win a game? Who was the first team they finally got a victory against? Oh my word, it was Brentford.
Daniel Farker's sort of farewell match, wasn't it, as well, yeah. Oh, the Bees are in trouble. I saw them at Emirates recently and, yeah, they're kind of... They don't look a goal threat. They're facing a lot of shots. In the last two games, they've faced 50 shots. 71 in their last four.
Can they complete a century this weekend?
Wow, it wouldn't surprise me. Probably not against Norwich. I just think that there may be... You talk about promoted teams having second season syndromes. I think with Brentford, they're suffering the second half of the season syndrome.
Which is like Hull.
Exactly. Like Blackpool. Opponents have had a look at them.
Blackpool, yeah.
And they're quick, they're powerful, they're really good in the air, they throw balls into the box, they're awkward. But if you can suss that out, what have they got? And the answer is they're kind of not master of anything, really. I was looking at some of the stats. You know, they're not a possession team. They've had, I think, 16 build-up attacks, which is the second lowest behind Burnley. So you think, well, they must be a counter-attacking side. Well, no. They've had, I think, 10 shots from counter-attacks all season, which is sort of among the lowest. So, yeah, they're sort of caught betwixt and between, I think. They, in my opinion, they need more of the ball. Just get on the ball.
If only they had some stats gurus at the club who could, you know, really get into those numbers.
What they might have is Christian Eriksen taking a bigger role in the game this weekend away at Carrow Road. But sorry, Tom.
Yeah, and just to say, I mean, obviously you've got Eriksen coming in who you'd expect will have a positive impact. And also Ivan Toney is now back fit, having missed a few games with a calf injury. And he is so key to the way they play. And, you know, there are lots of other decent attacking players at Brentford, but no one is as vital to the way they play as Toney, even if he hasn't scored anything like as many goals as he scored last season in the Championship. So, you know, with Eriksen now available, with Toney back, that does give them... reason for some optimism. But yeah, I think if they were to lose this game at Norwich, who've kind of slumped back into their travails after a mini revival, it will start to look quite serious.
Right, call it for us, Tom. Brentford to get the victory that's going to kickstart their recovery.
For all.
I was at this game last year when it was a Championship sort of top of the table, 6 points with no one there apart from the media team, and Norwich won it 1-0. But it was a very tight game. Brendier was brilliant. But Yeah, I think it's going to be low scoring. I don't think it's going to be 4-4.
Well, you heard it here first, folks.
A couple of other games we could probably write off as mid-table clashes. May well prove to be exciting, but in terms of significance at either end of the table, limited. Newcastle-Brighton, and Newcastle delighted probably now to be in that category. They've never beaten the Seagulls in the Premier League, intriguingly, in 9 meetings, although Brighton have had 3 defeats in a row. Also, Wolves taking on Crystal Palace. 3 of Palace's 4 wins since the turn of the year have come in the FA Cup. And Aston Villa facing Southampton. All those games at 3 o'clock on Saturday. On Sunday at 4:30, it's a Manchester derby, so we'll talk about that next.
Keep listening for Matt Davis-Adams versus Julien Laurent in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And we apologise for any bad language you may hear.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which is excellent news for Everton fans when they make their Lampardian transition from serious to funny to serious once again. Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Online exclusives and T's and C's apply.
Manchester derby and Liverpool West Ham. Which one are you more excited about, Charlie Eccleshare?
Of those two games?
Yes.
The Manchester derby.
Are you?
Yeah, I feel like West Ham are really running out of steam, so I don't know how... well, maybe famous last words, but I'd imagine Liverpool would win that reasonably comfortably, certainly if West Ham's performance against Southampton and a lot of their performance in the last few weeks are anything to go by. So the Manchester derby, also having seen City get so exposed against Spurs, that sort of feeling of invincibility with them has gone a bit. And United have... What, you know, they have done well against City in recent years. You know, they are City are a team who give you half the pitch to play into if you're good enough to exploit it on the counter. And United have some players who can do that.
Adrian has got a stat for us.
Yeah, away teams have won this fixture more than any other in the Premier League's history. It's remarkable. Yeah, Man City, Man United, 21. Away wins, which is just mad, really. Yeah, 3 in a row, I think, in all competitions for United at the Etihad. It's bonkers, really. I think this could be close. I really do. Because, yeah, City, apart from... You think about them at the Etihad this season against the better teams, apart from the sort of 5-0 spanking of Arsenal earlier on in the season, they've been tight games. And United have... You know, they're clearly not... going to be intimidated by going there. So, yeah, no, I think this would be interesting. I mean, anyone that saw the game at Old Trafford would find it unthinkable that Manchester United could get anything other than a 3-0 defeat here, but because it was so one-sided. But United are a funny team, and they always seem to score away from home, Manchester United. Even when they're not playing that well, they always seem to nick a goal. So, yeah, I think this is going to be a real challenging test for City.
How one-sided was it at Old Trafford? Well, the scoreline was 2-0, but City set a new Premier League record for passes completed. United's players also had more shots on their own goal than they did on City's goal, which is unusual. Pep Guardiola didn't even feel the need to make any substitutions.
Can I ask you a question, you guys? I want to put you into the shoes of Pep Guardiola here over team selection, right? The two top scorers at Man City this season are Raheem Sterling and Riyad Mahrez. Okay, they've scored a few penalties, but they are the top scorers. neither man has ever scored against Manchester United. It's 18 matches now for Raheem Sterling. It's 11 for Riyad Mahrez. Would that factor into your team selection if you were Pep Guardiola or not?
I don't think massively. I feel like those must be more quirks than anything else. I mean, if you had a player who consistently didn't score against any of the better teams, you might... And I know Sterling has a bad record against Liverpool, doesn't he? He's never scored against them either. I think that's right, or certainly he's never done anything at Anfield. No, I think if they're the two kind of in form... If you think they're sufficiently in form, I wouldn't be dissuaded by a bad record against an individual club. That feels too much of a quirk.
No, I agree. But once you're made aware of the stat, then you're like... Oh.
You can't unknow it, yeah.
I can picture the precise facial expression that Pep Guardiola would make if this was put to him in a pre-match or post-match interview. I suspect it's the sort of thing that he probably doesn't pay too much attention to. But it is a remarkable quirk. And it's one of those things that the longer it goes on, the more it becomes a thing. So I'm sure the players themselves will be aware of it, if not perhaps the manager.
Mm. Should West Ham have David Moyes back at home with COVID then when they go to Anfield? Because similarly, he's never won at Anfield as a visiting manager in 17 previous visits. Is that just a quirk as well?
I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, if David Moyes had a remarkable record as a visiting manager at all the other big clubs, then maybe yes. But as we know all too well, he does not. Right. So this is very much par for the course.
West Ham actually beat Liverpool in the reverse fixture back in November. They were the first team actually to defeat Klopp's side in the league. They were 25 games unbeaten at that point. Kurt Zouma scoring the winner that day. Charlie didn't feel much optimism for their chances of doing the double. So is it Liverpool potentially moving a bit closer to Man City this weekend, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they're in great nick, a bit of a juggernaut at the moment, aren't they? The forward players are in wonderful form. Luis Diaz just has a player ever settled into a new country, a new club, any better, any faster than Luis Diaz? I mean, it's quite remarkable, really. He's getting into so many good positions to shoot. His dribbling's been unbelievable. Just everything about him makes you feel as if he's been here for a year. So he's in great nick, as is Mo Salah. West Ham are a bit flat, aren't they? So, you know, Antonio's sort of searching for a bit of form. Jared Bowen's dried up a little bit. So, no, I think this is a match Liverpool will identify as one that they need to win, obviously, but they won't want to extend themselves too much because they got Inter Milan, haven't they?
Yeah,
around the corner.
I think they'll be all right. Inter once again goalless. I think that's four games in a row now they've failed to score in. Inter already Liverpool with a healthy lead from the clash at San Siro. Just wanted to ask Adrian, from your playing days, did a player ever do a no look pass to you? And if so, what was your reaction? What were the reaction of, given what was it, sort of six of his seven passes the other night were no look affairs?
I like a no look pass. It's just pure cockiness, isn't it? And yeah,
you've got to choose your moments, though. If you're doing a no-look pass for every pass, I mean...
Oh, no. You can't be doing it every single time. That's just that's just taking the piss, isn't it, basically?
Right.
So if I were to do six no-look passes out of seven, I would expect to be put into the front row of the supporters the next time I got the ball. I would expect to get absolutely clattered, and you'd have to take it on the chin, wouldn't you? So it's a bit too cocky. But
who, Adrian, of that Arsenal mid-90s group, who would have been the most likely to have done? I mean, we can imagine who would have been the least likely, but who'd have been most likely? I mean, would Ian Wright have had the cockiness?
It would have been Merson.
Right.
Merson. Yeah, he had the most flair. We weren't a team full of flair. I mean, Dennis Bergkamp was a half-decent player, but he was kind of quite straight in his brilliance. Or
clinical
in his craft. Yeah. He was very serious about his skill. Hmm. I think the no-look pass is frivolous, and that is a little bit Merson.
Well, I should mention that I completely made those numbers up, but it was a remarkable frequency with which he... You know, we'll be looking one way and pulling off some magic in totally the other. There you go. So essentially, Adrian's saying Liverpool are going to win and Man City are going to drop points. Tom and Charlie, before we move on to the Intertotally Cup, your view?
Yeah, I think Liverpool should win relatively comfortably against West Ham. And yeah, I can see the Manchester derby being quite close in the sense that, you know, as we know, United are sort of struggling to find a playing identity, and actually coming up against a team who will just deprive them of the ball but leave them space to attack might work well. We've seen that from United under a succession of managers now, that they are happier when they can just play as a counter-attacking team. And it reminds me a little bit of the way that England used to go into major tournaments, and you'd look at them just stinking out the group phase against countries who you knew they should be beating comfortably because the teams they were playing just sat deep and gave them the ball and they didn't know what to do. And then as soon as they came across someone half decent, you know, an Argentina or a Portugal, you saw what they could do because there was space to play in. And I think there are elements of that with United. And I can see it being close. I'm not sure I necessarily back United to pick up a win, but then given their form they've had in recent seasons, it wouldn't be a massive surprise if they did.
It's a slightly different interpretation of England's recent encounters with big nations at the tournaments.
Oh, no, I'm going back to like the good old days when England never stood a chance of winning anything. This is not a Gareth Southgate observation. I'm talking about your Euro 2004s, your World Cup 2006s.
World Cup 2006, very much in that process.
Okay, yeah. All right then.
Yeah, World Cup 2010. I mean, I could go on. Euro 2012.
Charlie.
Yeah, I think Liverpool will win, and then I think Spurs are probably the prototype to follow here for United with the way they dealt with City at the Etihad. But I think City, knowing Guardiola, he will also have learnt from that. And while United will push them, I think City will just about win this game. And just to answer, Adrian, your earlier question, has anyone ever settled so quickly? My mind went to Fabrizio Ravanelli, who scored a hat-trick on his debut for Borough and scored six in his first five in the Premier League.
That's a good call. That is a good call, yeah. Very last thing on this. Jared Bowen, if he plays in this game, he'll break Steve Potts' record for the most Premier League matches in succession. It'll be 78 Premier League matches in a row for Steve Potts. Wow. Yeah, for Jared Bowen. I mean, if you cast your mind back, when David Moyes signed Jared Bowen, he was quite disparaging. He was giving very strong signals that he wasn't somebody that he had recruited. It was the club that had recruited him. And he took a while to actually put him into the team. But once he's got into the side, basically he's just stayed there. And he's never got
anywhere. You can actually date West Ham's current sort of resurgence back to that January transfer window. Because I think Jared Bowen, and was it Thomas Suchet, came in the same month. And then by the end of the season, they were a different team.
Indeed.
Never thought we'd live to the day when Steve Potts' record went, but here we are.
There it is.
Very good. Well, that and other delights possibly in store this weekend. Next up, though, it's Intertotally time.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Game five, listener. This year's Intertotally Cup, it's a tough one this season, but of course there are no easy games in the Intertotally. So far, surviving a brutal first round, we've had Duncan Alexander, Flo Lloyd-Hughes, Benji Laniardo and Dom Fifield. Let's welcome our next two battlers for a place in the quarterfinals. If you really wanna fall to your five and you're back against the wall and a bunch of niggas need you to go away. Still going bad on them anyway. Saw you last night but did it all day.
Up first, he's a professional Frenchman who's never short of an opinion and has yet to turn down a single media appearance. All the way from Paris via Enfield, it's Julien Laurent.
Wow, Jules really milking that audience, and rightly so. Ladies and gentlemen, Jules, quarterfinalist in 2020, semi-finalist in 2021, third place medalist in our last edition of the Intertotally, just missing out on the final. Who beat you in the semi, Jules?
Benji, I think it was, somehow. I still don't know how that happened. But hey, miracles happen, you know, in this game now and again.
Well, I think I'm right in saying, checks notes, that if you get through this, you'll be up against Benji again. What a chance for revanche.
Revanche.
Revanche, even. Or, you know, whatever you want to take. All right. But first, you've got to get through this round. So let's meet the person you're up against.
And his opponent. He's a commentator, a dog walker, a podcast host, and a wrestling fan. He is the Barkston Rattlesnake, Matt Davis Adams.
Matt, strong, strong entrance music.
Yeah, for the uninitiated, that is Stone Cold Steve Austin, one of the greatest professional wrestlers of all time. That's his entrance music. At Clack Hanif, long-time listener, big into Totally Stan, put some pressure on me on Twitter to use a wrestler's entrance music. So I thought, that'll strike fear into the heart of my opponent.
Wow.
And from the looks of the Zoom, it has, yeah.
Yeah. All over the shop. All right, Matt. How are you feeling? You last couple of years, you've been eliminated by that Michael Cox both times.
Yeah, I have. And I'm glad you pointed that out, James, because there's a narrative that's been driven in large part by you, actually, about me not being very good at the quiz, which kind of ignores the fact that I put Rory Smith out last year and been knocked out by the two-time champion on both occasions. So, yeah, let's see how we get on today.
All right, you're up against the third place finisher from last time around. Of course, whoever does get through wins £10 for the charity of their choice, with Paddy Power putting that money on a bet of your choice. And the winnings, of course, going to the charity. What charity do you want to go for, Jules?
Dementia UK, please.
Okay. And what will your wager be?
My wager is Monaco to win away at the Velodrome in Marseille on Sunday night.
Very nice. Matt, what's your charity?
My charity is Grantham Food Bank, which is my local one and a division of Trussell Trust.
Okay. And your bet?
My bet is for this Saturday, Jesse Marsh to get off to a winning start, Leeds to win at Leicester in the early kickoff.
Crikey. Excellent stuff. Very good. Let's see who gets off to a winning start in this game of Intertotally. Julian, you're up first. Question one. Who was the first Italian to manage in the Premier League? Listeners already got their hand up. Gianluca Vialli is correct. Question two. When Ashley Cole moved from Arsenal to Chelsea, which player went in the opposite direction?
Lassana Diarra. No. Sorry. Gallas.
William Gallas is correct, but too late.
Although Lassana Diarra was part of the deal as well for $5 million.
We're not.
Throw that open to the adjudication panel, which is Matt Davis Adams as our Chelsea expert. What do you think, Matt?
No chance.
What? Apparently not. I mean, so question three, Jules. Who is the only Mexican player to have a Premier League winner's medal?
Chicharito?
Is correct. A.K.A. Javier Hernandez. Question four. Which player finished top scorer at the recent Africa Cup of Nations?
Vincent Aboubakar?
Is correct. A very solid 3 out of 4 so far. Here comes question five. Who is the next name on this list? Ronaldo, Miroslav Klose, Thomas Müller, James Rodriguez, and
Antoine Griezmann?
I'm afraid not. It's Harry Kane. They are the last 5 World Cup Golden Boot winners.
Oh, I thought Griezmann was the World Cup.
No, Harry Kane. Yeah, 3 out of 5. What do you think? Is it going to be enough?
4 or 5, really. But, you know, I give. I mean, Matt needs a head start, so I give him that point.
All right. Bold words as Matt prepares for his first question, which, Matt, is question one. Jesse Marsh is the third American to manage in the Premier League. Name the other two.
Bob Bradley. Oh, I'm struggling with the other one. I've got to be honest. American manager. No, I don't know, I'm afraid.
It's David Wagner.
Come on.
Yeah.
Yes, Matt. He's an American international.
Yeah, all right. I mean, for clarity, listener, the original question there was name one of the Americans to previously manage, which I did instantly. So, I mean, I'll leave it up to you. Who's the real winner?
Question two, Matt. When Andy Cole moved from Newcastle to Manchester United, which player went in the opposite direction?
Keith Gillespie.
Is correct. You need 2 more to tie, Jules, and force a tiebreaker. Question three. Who is the only Bulgarian player to have a Premier League winner's medal?
Dimitar Berbatov.
Is correct. 2 out of 3. This to tie Julien Laurens, who was named player of the tournament at the recent Africa Cup of Nations.
I don't know the answer to this, so I will have a guess, and I will say Kalidou Koulibaly.
I'm afraid not, Matt. It was Sadio Mane. Question 5, then. This is key. Who is the next name on this list? Oliver Kahn, Zinedine Zidane, Diego Forlan, Lionel Messi, and who? Oliver Kahn, Zinedine Zidane, Diego Forlan, Lionel Messi, and?
Okay. Can you just give me them one more time, please?
Sure. Oh my God, how many times? Like, what was this? Like,
Oliver Kahn, Zinedine Zidane, Diego Forlan, Lionel Messi, and then who? I think you know what the connection is. You're just trying to remember who the next person
is. I don't.
Is.
I honestly don't know what the connection is. That's the problem. Forlan is the one that's really thrown
me.
Yeah,
that's a curveball. And Jules nodding away happily is not going to help either.
No. I just wonder if, you know, how long until the day we have for this, you know?
Is it like
got the, no plans, the, yeah.
the player of the tournament at the World Cup, I think. So who would it have been at the last World Cup? Luka Modric?
Oh, my word. Pulled that one out of the fire.
Oh, but he had half an hour. Winding
down. Jules, you leapt at your answers. I have to feel if you'd taken a little bit more time, then maybe you would have been...
Nah, this is the quiz. You don't have, like, all the lifetime to answer.
Reflections of last year's quiz here, Jules, to be honest. I mean... There's a good way to win and a bad way to win.
People know.
Nobody's won yet, though, listener, because we're now 3-3. We're on to our tiebreaker question. The first time we've gone to a tiebreaker in this year's tournament. Both Jules and Matt will try and text me the answer first to the following question. Leonardo Bonucci became the oldest player to score in a European Championship final when he equalised against England last summer. How old was he in years and days? Nearest answer takes you through.
Total guess from me. No idea. There you go.
Matt's in. Just waiting for Jules's. Come on, Jules, we haven't got all day.
Well, the tables have turned.
Exactly. There you go.
All right, listener, the answers are in. Let's have a look. Matt says 38 years, 165 days. Jules says 34 years and 6 months. The answer, 34 years and 71 days. Jules, you're going to the quarterfinals.
Get in! There's a justice in this world.
I was about to say, well done, Jules. That was a really good guess. But you know what? Benji, I hope you're stuffing, mate.
Oh, man, I do love you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to have knocked out a good friend and a good contenders. Although that's how many times now he loses in the first round?
2 out of 3 to the both times to the eventual champion. So let's see how you get on against Benji. And then, you know, if you ever get drawn against Coxie, then you know. I'll be interested. I'll be an interested spectator. Let's put it that way. But no, best of luck for the rest of the tournament.
Yeah, Matt, you're now rooting for Jules to keep your record of only getting beaten by the champion alive, of course. But a valiant effort. And you came so close, that Modric answer.
Just 4 years.
Anyway, we look forward to speaking to you soon on the pod in a nod quiz answering a role, but Jules, you'll go through and you'll be facing Benji in the next round. Oh my word.
Zut alors, Julien, you're through to the next round of Le Coupe de Intertotally. And if, like Jules, you think that Monaco will win away at Marseille this weekend, you'll find it priced at 21 to 10 at paddypower.com and on the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only, and please gamble responsibly.
That was dramatic. Not as dramatic, though, listener. as watching Tom Williams' face while all that was unfolding, answering, by the looks of it, Tom, was it 5 out of 5 on Jules' questions?
Yeah, 9 out of 10 overall. I mean, it just shows when the pressure's not on. I'm like the Asafa Powell of the Intertotally quiz in your sort of, you know, your Zurich and Oslo, your Ostrava meets. I'm absolutely smashing it. And then when, you know, when the lights go down at the 100 metres final in the Olympics, I'm nowhere to be found.
Adrian, you did pretty well as well.
Yeah, better than I did for real as well. Yeah, it's just, it's frustrating. I'll always have nightmares about Stuart Pearce. That's the question that got away. Really, disappointing. Yeah.
Of course, all this is still to come for you, Charlie. When's your big game?
Must be soon.
It must be. Just going
to. But I'm trying not to think too much about. I'm just sort of living in the moment, taking each prep day as it comes.
Right, you're up against James Horncastle. Right. Mm.
Yeah. Mm. It's going to be spicy.
I think so. A lot of people have Charlie Eccleshare down as, I mean, he's a quizzer with pedigree. It's a tough draw, that I think, for Horncastle. Charlie, potentially a dark horse for this year's Intertotally. That's what they're saying, Charlie.
Listen, that's for others to say. It's not. All I can do is my best. So,
all right,
we'll see.
Well, Monday it's going to be Rory Smith against Lindsay Hooper, and then potentially either Thursday, Charlie, it's you against the Horn, or the following Monday, the other first round tie-up. There is, of course, that Daniel Story, Michael Cox affair. Anyway, lots to look forward to. We're back on Monday. The small matter of. We're back on Monday with that and much more. So do join us then. For now, many thanks to Lee Wingate and Adam Crafton, and to Tom and Adrian and Charlie and producer Charlie and you, listener. Have a great weekend, everyone. Get well soon, Adrian, and we'll speak to you Monday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.